I'd like to welcome everyone this morning to the Second Court of Appeals. We appreciate your being here and arguing this case for us. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and to my left is Justice Dabney Basil, and then I'm Chief Justice Bonnie Sedderth. Before we begin, also, I'll have the clerk call the case. Thank you.
The court will now call 43 Colony versus the independent executors of the estate of Peter C. Kern et al. And may it please the court, Mr. Byron K. Henry to argue for the appellant, Mr. Sean Higgins to argue first for the appellee, and Mr. Clint Corey to argue second for the appellee.
You may begin.
May it please the court. Thank you, Chief Justice Sutter, Justice Kerr, Justice Basil. My name is Byron Henry. I'll be arguing on behalf of the appellant, 423 Colony Limited, today. This case began as a suit to enforce an unconditional guarantee of payment for default under a lease. What appears to me should have been a simple calculation of the amounts owed under an unambiguous lease on an unambiguous guarantee, basically calculating the amounts owed and reasonable attorney's fees to collect it, turned into what is basically a three-year case with multiple summary judgments and hearings, 9 days of trial that focused primarily on the tenant's defenses to the lease as opposed to anything to do with the guarantee, the guarantor, or the terms of the guarantee. Instead of a case in which our client is attempting to get the commercial landlord attempting to get the amount of rent due under the lease to which he was entitled under the guarantee, as well as his fees, to the tune of about $571,000 in change in rent plus reasonable and necessary attorney's fees, my client, the commercial tenant, 423 Colony, ended up owing the guarantor, the unconditional guarantor, approximately $300,000 in fees and costs plus conditional appellate fees. Judge Robeson did a good job trying the case. There was a wrong turn at a foundational level on construction and application of an unconditional guarantee of payment, which led to the problem and basically set the law in Texas on unconditional guarantees of payment on its head. And my client, the appellant in this case, has asked this court to set that right. I think the crux of the dispute is a legal one, not a factual one, although you have a lot of briefing on a lot of defenses under the lease that were found as factual in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, which was necessary, of course, for preservation purposes in the chance the court disagreed with our first and second issues. I believe this case can be decided on the first issue, and that is a simple application of Texas law on unconditional guarantees of payment, which I'm not sure the other side disagrees this is one. I think we just have a fundamental disagreement on what it means. They tend to take the view that an unconditional guarantee of payment simply means you don't have to sue the principal obligor first, but everything else is the same. Unfortunately, that's not the law. That's not the cases we've cited, and they haven't cited any cases to the contrary.
So, Mr. Henry, you don't find anything significant about the recital that refers to joint and several liability?
Whereas clause you're referring to, Justice Kerr, that says that the guarantor will be liable to the tenant
to the same extent as if it was
jointly severally liable, and of course we've cited the Hopkins case that explains when you talk about to the extent, you have to look at that in connection with the entire. That just means that they're liable for as much as they can be liable for up to the same amount as if they're joint and severally liable. But of course, unless there's something ambiguous in the operative clauses of the guarantee, the recital is simply that, a recital. This court and other courts have said that if there's anything in the body of the guarantee that says something contrary to the recital, the operative clauses control unless there's an ambiguity. And here, there could be no ambiguity. As we pointed out in our brief, the guarantee says on its face it's unconditional guarantee of payment multiple times in the first paragraph. It basically conditions, the only condition of payment is a default. by the tenant, this court's Bishop case, and lots of other cases, not just this court's case, but this court has a case which says the hallmark of an unconditional guarantee is one that sets the only condition as a default by the principal obligor, in this case, the tenant. Not only that, but this is also a fundamental difference. They make a statement in their response brief that says this is not an independent obligation of the guarantor, which is basically, in one sentence, the key to their entire case. If it is an independent obligation, then everything else about the tenant and the actual landlord goes out the window. The problem is that in paragraph 11, it says, word for word, that this is a primary obligation of the guarantor. I mean, it literally says the opposite of their main position in the case, that this is going to be a primary obligation. And in fact, in the Bohart case, or the Universal Metals, however you, the Supreme Court talked a lot about primary versus secondary obligations, and basically in a case in which the underlying note on which the guarantee was given was forged. So in that case, it's basically not even a legal instrument, according to the case law. I mean, a forged note is nothing. As the Supreme Court has said, fraud taints everything it touches. In that case, you've got forgery. But in that case, the court said when you have an unconditional guarantee of payment, it's as if the person signing the guarantee signed the note, and no one argued that the guarantee was a forgery. So the guarantor was primarily and fully liable for the note, even though the note that was guaranteed was forged. That should pretty much end the matter, since here we have prior breach and estoppels and fraudulent inducement defenses. But it didn't. But just in case the court is hesitant on that, there's more. All of the defenses on which they rely apply to the lease and not the guarantee. Secondly, the guarantee itself expressly says any unenforceability of the lease or other irregularity, and there's an entire provision, has no effect on the validity of the guarantee. So if you were confused about whether or not this was primary, if that whereas clause creates some uncertainty and says, well, maybe there's some wiggle room in a whereas clause and maybe there's an ambiguity somewhere in this guarantee, there's nothing ambiguous about a provision in an unconditional guarantee that says, if the lease is unenforceable, you still owe under the guarantee, which is exactly what this guarantee says. Not only that, it has a limited waiver of defenses. Now, I agree with my friends on the other side. There is not a waiver of defense clause that the Supreme Court has dealt with often in these instances. It doesn't say all defenses are waived. It doesn't have a general waiver of defenses. It does say, however, that the guarantor can't skirt its obligations or avoid paying under the guarantee based on any act or omission by my client. Every one of their defenses, assuming you even allow defenses, we're past the whole can they even raise the defenses under the primary obligation theory. Even if they can raise defenses, there's a provision in the guarantee that says their obligations under the guarantee cannot be impaired, released, or otherwise diminished by any conduct by my client. So they've got failure to mitigate, they have equitable estoppel, they say we failed to disclose, that's an omission, they say we misrepresented, that's an act. So in addition to the fact that they're primary liable and should have just been liable at the outset without being able to raise defenses, assuming this court says, well, maybe they can raise some defenses, well, the guarantee says certain ones you cannot. Not all of them.
It is a commercial landlord's duty to is it the duty to mitigate a defense or part of your burden of proof?
It's always a defense, Your Honor. In fact, it doesn't even go. In fact, cases in which the tenants or the party proving up failure to mitigate, they have to plead it, they have to prove it. All it is a reduction in damages. And even in cases where they completely vindicate their failure to mitigate, for instance, they're taking a 50% cut, the court still award the attorney's fees to the plaintiff if they prevail on the lease because their argument is you owe us past and future rent. The defendant is only saying we don't owe you quite as much as you say. So even if they fully vindicate their defense, the case law still awards attorney's fees under leases to the party that proves the breach of the lease and recovers damages. So in this case, even had they been successful in mitigating, alleging they can even bring the defense in the first place as an unconditional guarantor, and then they have to get around the actual terms of the guarantee, which say that they can't raise defenses based on our conduct, which would be failure to mitigate or an omission, failure to mitigate. They would still owe us money. I mean, even Judge Robeson's last finding after she went through all the defenses to the lease determined that even under their own expert's theory, they still owe us future rent. We disagree with the idea that we have to mitigate, first of all, under the property code with respect to a guarantor, and that they can raise that defense, of course, but even then, we're still supposedly owed money. Another argument they've made, and they made it in the trial court on numerous occasions, is that notes are different. I think we've cited enough cases in our brief to show that the court doesn't change their construction of unconditional guarantees based on whether it's a UCC instrument, a note, or a lease. And in fact, we've got interchanging cases in our brief. But their argument is basically, well, a note's different because it's for a sum certain. And of course, the case that I cited, the Little Joe's Trawlers and the Hopkins case, explains how you always have to consult the underlying obligatory document to determine the amount owed. So we are not saying that you don't even look at the lease, obviously, and you just look at the guarantee, you wouldn't know how much money was owed. But the court explained in that case that that's the only reason you look at the underlying principal obligatory document, is to determine the amount owed. And in a note case, you have to find out how much is still owed, give credit for past payments, figure out interest and late fees, and come up with a number. In a lease, you do the same thing. You look at the lease, you see how much is owed, you give credit for past payments, you figure out how much is owed currently for past due payments and future payments, you add interest and late fees, and then you come up with a number. So consulting the lease is not verboten, nor is it an admission when we consult the lease to find out how much is owed to say, oh, you're looking at the lease. See, the lease is part of the deal. Basically, I couldn't find a better example of an unconditional guarantee of payment except to say this. This one kind of says it like multiple times, and it looks like this one was cobbled together from like four or five different ones in commercial leases, and actually has enough language in like four different paragraphs to satisfy unconditional guarantee of payment, and it just said it like in multiple places. So once we get past that, I think the case is relatively simple. It should have been a judgment in my client's favor for whatever the amount of owed rent was, plus reasonable and necessary attorney's fees. If you get to the issue of any types of defenses, I would say that we don't think that they're applicable here because of the guarantee. The guarantee basically says the defenses they can raise, or says the ones they can't, and the ones they raised actually are applied. I think they may have abandoned some in their brief as well because we didn't get a response in their response brief defending them. And there's a number of the defenses that are, there's no findings. There's just one line that says there's a prior material breach, but there's no elements. Prior material breach is obviously problematic because we don't have any obligations under the guarantee. So I don't know how we could have breached the guarantee. And to the extent we breach the lease, the guarantee takes care of that and says they're not off the hook because of anything we may have done. But I want to talk just for a minute about the defenses that I think Judge Robeson, once she decided that if you can, using the recital that Justice Kerr pointed out, and once you construe the documents together, she kind of, I believe, I wasn't there in the trial court till the very end after the trial for post-judgment. But I believe that Judge Robeson kind of took the case law that says you construe instruments together, took the fact that this guarantee was an exhibit to the lease as opposed to a separate document, and took that whereas clause and put it together and just said, I'm going to review this as one transaction and not treat the guarantee as a separate independent obligation separate and apart from the lease. So once she did that, she proceeded to have a trial on all of the defenses that would apply to any contract, including statutory fraud and fraud. The problem with statutory fraud is there's no omission in statutory fraud. It's only for misrepresentations direct. The misrepresentation that's been alleged with respect to the legal description is a red herring. That's not a misrepresentation. It's not even a representation. It's an exhibit as part of the lease agreed to by the parties. It's not a representation or warranty. So both the parties agreed that the legal description of this property was this. It may not be, but first of all, that's an agreement by the parties. That's not my party telling him that that's the legal description, or him for that matter telling us that it's the legal description. Secondly, it's immaterial because that is a legal description of the entire shopping center, and the only reason it's there is to locate the lease premises. There's never been an argument that anyone in this case had any problem finding or knowing what premises were being actually leased. Another thing that the court should keep in mind, just generally that applies to all of these defenses with respect to injury or damages, is none of the actual impairment occurred. Based on their own testimony, there was a death by the person that was funding the entity, which caused it to default, which caused it to file bankruptcy, which caused them to basically go out of business. Later, the state decided to start doing some construction. The condemnation happened before, but any change in the parking or common areas never occurred. So they were delivered the lease premises as promised and as represented. They were in the lease premises as promised and represented. They defaulted and left the lease premises in its exact same condition as when they entered it. And we sued to recover the rest of the rent. And that's when we heard that because there was a prior condemnation that you didn't tell us about that might have in the future ended up impairing our property after we had defaulted and left, we don't owe you rent and you actually owe us attorney's fees.
Well, you don't think that a tenant knowing that there had been a condemnation and a potential expansion of Main Street would have tried to get a lower lease amount?
They might have, certainly. And in fact, the lease itself, pardon me, Your Honor, my time is up. May I finish answering your question? The lease itself contemplates condemnations, both substantial and partial. The parties negotiated what happens if this leasehold premises or the property is impaired substantially or if it's just partially, and it's actually dealt with in the document itself. But the document itself says that none of that occurs until the impairment actually happens. So the actual condemnation process is irrelevant to the parties for purposes of when they actually have to settle up. The settling up occurs when the actual impairment occurs. So it never occurred. So the parties actually foresaw this problem, negotiated for it. That contingency just didn't occur while the tenant was in the property.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I am going to yield the last 4 minutes to my co-counsel, Clint Corey, who will discuss mitigation and the issues raised by appellants as to the evidence relating to mitigation. Colony's argument asks the court to disregard the fact that the guarantee was part of a single transaction, and it asks the court to ignore the plain language of the guarantee. First, part of a single transaction. The guarantee was an addendum to the lease. The guarantee was given in consideration for entering into the lease.
Isn't that generally true, though? I mean, isn't it generally true that the reason you have a guarantee is because one party demands it to effectuate the transaction?
Well,
why would you have a guarantee if the other side wasn't demanding that it be guaranteed?
Well, that is correct, and there's nothing exceptional about this case, because if there's fraud as to Cheers. Cheers entered into the lease in consideration for having the right to occupy that end cap with the common areas, with the setback as represented. And Mr. Kern gave the guarantee in consideration for Cheers' ability to occupy that end cap as represented. The end cap was not as represented. And so a fraud as to Cheers is a fraud as to Mr. Kern. They are all the same. But more than that, we have the language of the guarantee. And first,
I would like to put it up.
Yes, sir.
Paragraph 1, I think, is the key paragraph that they read out of this. That is the undertaking paragraph, the critical paragraph of the guarantee. And what it says is the guarantor guarantees the prompt performance of lessee's obligations. The obligations need to arise. Payment when due of all rents and charges coming due, and damages that may arise or may be incurred by the lessor. The court needs to look, a court properly to determine the undertaking, to determine what is owed under this undertaking, under this paragraph. The court needs to determine what is actually owed under the lease. And the trial court properly considered the defenses to the lease.
Well, in that case, are you asking us to read into that paragraph one payment when and if due, as opposed to just payment when due?
Well, I don't think that if is a required word there. Payment when due, when carries with it a contingency. Plus, we need to look at rents, charges, and additional sums. You need to determine the actual liability under the lease. And finally, damages that may arise. This was a claim for damages. This was not an insurance policy. But more important than that, or as important, we have the fifth whereas clause. Now, the whereas clause is not a recital. A recital states the background leading up to the transaction and the party's reasons for entering into the transaction. That does neither. It's a statement of the party's intent, and it's a statement that Mr. Kern will be liable jointly and severally. Jointly and severally means the same liability. So to accept the estate's to accept Colony's interpretation, you need to read out that whereas clause. Now,
but doesn't the guarantee also provide in paragraph 11 that no invalidity, irregularity, and unenforceability shall infect or impair or constitute a defense to this guarantee?
Yes, it does, and I think that speaks to technical invalidities. That's the forgery situation. I don't think it speaks to a defense. And again, you have to look to the undertaking, and the undertaking is in paragraph 1. And the undertaking in paragraph 1 is related to actual liability. And this is really the Silver Lion case out of the Houston Court of Appeals. That case is cited in our brief. It's 2010 TexApp Lexus 3873, 2010 Westlaw 2025749. And that case also involved a commercial lease, a guarantee of a commercial lease. And the same argument was advanced. Well, it's an unconditional lease. They are liable, even though there is a subsequent agreement. Subsequent management agreement that released the lessee of rental obligations. The landlord argued that that did not matter because it was an unconditional guarantee of payment. The Houston Court of Appeals disagreed with that. And what the Houston Court of Appeals latched onto or found very significant was the statement in Silver Lion that the guarantee was for performance of the lessee's obligations. Same guarantee in this case. And to quote the case, what the court said, for purposes of determining payment of rents, this language cannot be read in isolation from the lease, because as the plain language of the guarantee states, it is a guarantee of the performance of the tenant's obligations under the lease.
But did Silver Lion involve a guarantee that expressly said it was unconditional? Was that language in the Silver Lion guarantee?
Yes, it was. And it was, I think the language may have been even stronger in the Silver Lion guarantee.
But in the Silver Lion case, didn't the contract itself provide that some certain amounts of rent would be forgiven?
Well, there is a subset agreement between the lessee and the landlord. There was a management agreement to run the nightclub, and that provided that certain amounts would be given.
And but so when you look back to those documents, you see that that's not an amount that would be owed under the lease, because the lease provided it would be forgiven.
No, the lease did not provide that. There is a subsequent agreement that provided that. What the landlord said is unconditional guarantee of payment, King's X. They owe us all the money, irrespective of the fact that there's a subsequent agreement and that the landlord does not actually owe it. And the court said it's axiomatic that if the tenant has no obligations to pay rents under the lease, the guarantor has no obligation to pay the rents either. Unconditional guarantee, they are attaching, the estate is attaching a significance to the words unconditional guarantee of payment that does not otherwise exist. The law and the cases that they cited all stand for the proposition that an unconditional guarantee of payment waives conditions. It waives the condition that the obligor needs to look to the principal, needs to exhaust collection efforts against the principal first before turning to the guarantor. And the cases they cite, for one, the Bohart case, it's a different case. In Bohart, the guarantors signed, their signature, their guarantee signature appeared on the note. There is a finding of forgery of the corporation's signature on the note, but the guarantors did not dispute that the note was signed. The guarantors did not dispute that the corporation received the benefit of what it was bargaining for when it signed the note. There was none of that. It was that is not this case. There was no defense in that case as to the actual amount owed. There was only a technical defense, and that's what paragraph 11 is, any unenforceability of the lease or any defects in the guarantee or the lease. But in looking at the other cases that they cite, I mean, they deal with conditions. U.S. v. Little Joe's Crawlers, which they cite, the issue in that case was, does a guarantor have an obligation does a guarantor have a right to receive notice of acceleration? Again, a condition, not a defense. Doesn't go to the actual amount owed. The time I have left, I'll talk briefly about fraud.
Well, you don't have any time left if you wanted to reserve 4 minutes to your colleague. Okay. Yes, you may. Sure. Go ahead.
Thank you. There were three instances of misrepresentations in this case. There was, first of all, at the initial point of contact, the schematic that was sent. And the schematic showed an ample setback, ample parking. When they visited the site, they saw the site. They did not see any evidence of the taking when they visited the site. What they saw is shown on this photograph that was admitted in evidence at the prod. This outer yellow line right here is the space that the end cap enjoyed between the building and the right-of-way, ample space. The yellow line
is what was going to actually happen.
But isn't it significant that it never happened while Cheers was in business?
No, it isn't. And the reason is it was a 10-year lease. It was entered into in reliance on the notion that those common areas, that parking, that exposure would be there for 10 years.
So you disagree with Mr. Henry's point that paragraph or Article 8 of the lease itself, which dealt with what would happen if there was a condemnation, that that was sort of a built-in way to take care of any future impairments?
Absolutely, because that is not what Article 8 says. Article 8 speaks to a contingency. Should the contingency, the possibility of a taking occur, this is what will happen. It doesn't speak to a taking already having occurred. Those are two different things. And I would argue that Article 8 points up to the materiality of this. This was a 10-year lease. There's testimony in the record that if Cheers and Kern had known, they would not have entered into that lease. They would not have entered into a 10-year lease at that price. That is fraud in the inducement. That is a very clear case. I think an analog to their argument would be, well, if I know that I saw termites in my attic, I sell my house, I don't disclose that, and 3 years later the house falls down because of termite damage and the buyer sues me. And my defense is, well, there was no termite damage at the time. That's what their argument is. That's what their argument is. This is a clear case of fraud. It's a clear case of misrepresentation. And Cheers relied on those misrepresentations, and Kern relied on them when he signed the guarantee for a 10-year lease at a high market rate.
Would the home buyer have a cause of action if the house burned down a year after they bought it? Termite damage never came to fruition?
But that is that, yeah, they may. And because the issue is the inducement, the entry into the contract, the agreement that they would not have otherwise entered into. The fraud in the inducement is a defense. It excuses performance. And unless there are any other questions, I will yield.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I learned something in torts when I was in law school, and it was that we don't concede that there were misrepresentations here, and certainly if it's a failure to disclose, that wouldn't be statutory fraud anyway, because that's not part of statutory fraud. So if they're now relying almost solely on failing to talk about the condemnation, then that's problematic for statutory fraud. But I learned that the law allows people to lie to people or not tell them things as long as it doesn't harm them. So to Justice Basil's question, the answer to that is, the better analogy, I think, is that, you know, you check a thing on your disclosures that whether or not your property is conducive to termites. Like, there's dirt up over the foundation and different things. If that's false, the question is, do they have a cause of action if they never get termites, and can they get out of the, you know, if they move out of their house or default and the bank comes to get it, can they sue to get out of the contract to buy their house because of that misrepresentation, even if they never receive termites? And the answer to that is, fraud in the inducement has the same elements as a defense as it does as a cause of action, and there's no case law to say any otherwise. So the fact is they never suffered any harm, even assuming all the elements were met and all the briefing that was done.
Tell us how you distinguish the Silver Lion case.
Silver Lion, Your Honor, was about determining the amount owed. He actually used those terms. That is what Silver Lion is about. You can go to the document to determine how much is owed. Obviously, we would not be able to sue them for all of the payments that have been made by Cheers. Even though the total amount due under the entire lease is for 10 years, they had been paying for two. We don't get to sue the guarantor for the 2 years they've already paid. All of the guarantee case law talks about the amounts due. You're allowed to look at the note and find out how much is due and owing under the document.
Does it make any difference if there's two documents rather than one document, as he said in Silver Lion occurred?
I have two answers to that. First of all, I'd say no, because the case law doesn't distinguish it. That's their hope to get away from a case that has been cited, last I checked, over 80 times for this proposition about the forged underlying document, and in a ton of those cases cited, they're not the same document. But one of their whole cases, one of their building blocks of their whole case is that this is one document, that the guarantee is part of the lease. So if anything, that fact hurts them under Bohart, because the guarantee is the same person, corporation and its principal, and it's in the same document. So I can't imagine how that distinction would help them under the Universal Metals case. They haven't made that distinction in their briefing, by the way. Their only distinction to the trial court and to this court in briefing was notes are different, which I think is factually incorrect. But I'd also like to mention something we've heard a lot at the trial court, and we've heard a lot about the common areas, because no one disputes that the lease premises, properly defined, was ever impaired. They argue that the least amount of the rent is based on the total amount of square footage they're allocated in the common areas and the lease premises, but the lease premises is just the end cap. If you look, and I'm not going to read it based on time, and I don't want you to listen to me after read, but if you look at section 3.10 of the lease called common areas, it gives the landlord absolute and complete discretion on parking, designating common areas, selling and buying land, expanding the shopping center, and removing the shopping center. So to the extent their entire case is, we thought we were getting this access and this parking, they bargained that away in 3.10 when it says that they will be able to be used from time to time in the discretion of the lessor, which is my client, which in other words, and there's more, that's just one sentence. So in 3.10, it's basically my client's decision about parking, about buying and selling off land, about expanding or shrinking the shopping center or the ingress and egress. So if that's their case, then the lease handles it. They have no right to say that we misrepresented the common area and its usage or its ingress and egress, because when they actually signed the merged integrated document, they basically told us, that's in your hands, landlord. You handle the common areas. We understand we have no bargain for right to a certain number of parking or an ingress or egress or a certain amount of square footage in the common area, and that's actually in the lease. I'd just also like to mention that the payment when due, the when not if question, that is a condition. Obviously, if you add if, that's the whole reason. If this isn't an unconditional guarantee for payment of obligations that are due and owing without going into why they are doing owing, that is the condition. Why aren't they due and owing? If it's Silver Lion, that's not owing. It's not an amount owed. If it's every other case, it's we don't get into fraud, any other defenses. And I don't know where the limitation on the provision regarding the defenses are, but it is any and all, and it is as broad as you can get in the waiver of defenses. So we believe that that would cover this, even if they're allowed to bring up defenses. So we've just asked the court to reverse the trial court's judgment, and in this case, render judgment for the undisputed amounts owing to my client that was proved up at trial.
Thank you. Counselors, we appreciate your argument today. Your case has been submitted. We thank you for being here. You're now free to go.
Thank you all.